I'm Mark Labberton, president of Fuller Theological Seminary. Welcome to Conversing. What a joy it is today to welcome Dr. Francis Collins as our guest on Conversing. Dr. Collins, as many of you will know, has stepped down in December after 12 years serving as the director of the National Institutes of Health. He's a remarkable person in so many different ways. His academic training and work has really been as a physician geneticist. He took the role of the NIH director in 2009, and when he retired, he had been the longest serving presidentially appointed head of the NIH, which is no mean task, not least in the times and troubles of the NIH and of the world, in part at least of the season that he has been serving. So I am grateful for the opportunity and privilege of having you as a guest. Francis, welcome.
Well, thank you, Mark. It's a privilege to be your guest. You and I have known each other for quite a few years, and in the past couple of years, maybe got to see a little bit more of each other because we happen to be fortunate to be in the same book club, which I've learned a lot from by mostly being quiet and listening to others with much greater wisdom hold forth about whatever it was that we have read. Greatly admire everything you have done at Fuller, and it's great to be with you here today.
Of course. That's a classic Francis Collins turnaround, because I think if you were to ask the people in our book club who they've learned from, you would be at the top of the list. So you're very gracious and generous. Francis, it's just really hard to even begin to figure out how to measure the scope of the things that have been on your plate and the service that you've given to the nation and to the world through the NIH in recent years. And before that, specifically to the Human Genome Project and through your establishment of an organization called BioLogos about the relationship between faith and science. All of these various domains, all simultaneous and all in recent years in the face of this extraordinary global virus. Just give us a sense of the landscape of your life. If you were to use, let's say, two or three words to just give us a flavor of what life has been like in the last, let's say, 3 years in particular, what words would you use?
I would say exhilarating, exhausting, and mostly unpredictable.
Yes, yes. So much unpredictability. Tell us about the exhilarating part.
This is an amazing time for science, Mark. Things are possible now in medical research that I never dreamed would happen in my lifetime. We are curing sickle cell disease, something that I dreamed of when I was in training and thought, well, maybe the next century, but not so soon. We are figuring out how the brain works in a fashion that is well beyond what I thought would be possible. We are curing patients with cancer who you would have thought there was no hope for by activating the immune system and getting that to come to their rescue. We have turned HIV into a treatable disease that's associated with almost normal lifespan. And we have developed vaccines against COVID-19 in 11 months, when the previous record was about 5 years. And not only have those vaccines been done quickly, they've turned out to be just about the most effective vaccines ever made. So it's an exhilarating time, and it gets better. We're on this rising curve of medical research discovery with all the promise that holds for alleviating suffering and saving lives.
Well, I'm eager to have you share a bit more about that in just a second, but also let us in a bit on, for example, the sickle cell research, because that disease, which is so unbelievably insidious, has just been a deep crisis for anyone who's been affected by it and the families of people that are affected by the systemic qualities of it. So give us a glimpse into that as an example of what's happening.
So sickle cell disease is a genetic condition. In fact, it was the first molecular disease where people actually figured out exactly what was the glitch, which was a misspelling in one of the hemoglobin genes. It's very common in sub-Saharan Africa because it protects you against malaria if you have one copy of the sickle gene. Unfortunately, if you have two copies, then you have the disease. So many of us have hoped, knowing as much as we did about this, that by now there would be an effective therapy. It's been very slow coming. And frankly, the investment in research in sickle cell disease has not perhaps been what it should be. And I am sorry to say that may be a reflection of the fact that there's not a big support group for sickle cell the way there is for cystic fibrosis or other diseases, because sickle cell affects primarily African Americans with limited resources. So it is a source of great personal excitement to see that what we are now able to do with gene therapy in a very small number of cases, it still needs to be greatly extrapolated, not just provide benefit, but actually it looks like cure people with this disease so that they're permanently returned to normal as far as their blood panel. They stop having the terrible pain crises that are just unbelievably difficult to live with. And that's a dream come true. Now, we have to figure out how we can take those advances and make them available to the 100,000 sickle patients in the U.S. And I have a big program right now working with Bill Gates on how we might take the current approach, which is very high tech, and figure out how to make it something that could be administered in a low resource setting safely and effectively, because most patients with sickle cell disease live in low resource settings in sub-Saharan Africa. That would be a real dream. And I think in 10 years, we might achieve it.
Wow. Where does that happen along the age spectrum? Does this intervention potentially affect and work for people across generations, or is it just at a certain age level?
The symptoms of sickle cell disease usually appear in a child about age 1.5 or 2. And then over the course of time, more serious things start to happen. Strokes in childhood are not unusual. Without treatment, survival is only about age 35 or 40, and it's a very difficult life experience for most of that. But at this point, we've mostly applied the treatment to adults. FDA is always nervous about going into something uncertain and experimental in children, but I think we ought to be pretty close now. And of course, the best outcome is if you can do the treatment before the damage has been done to various organ systems. So my dream would be that we would start to be able to treat kids at age 3 or 4 and pretty much rescue them from most of the ravages of this disease for life.
What an extraordinary achievement that would be. Amazing.
Yes.
Francis, when you look ahead at the things that are coming, you mentioned progress with cystic fibrosis, but what other areas or types of disease are you the most excited about with the work that's being done right now?
Well, I am very focused on what's possible in cancer. That is, after all, a condition that still takes far too many lives and for which we have made major advances, but we have more to do. We actually have seen cancer deaths drop by 25% since the turn of the century. People may not be aware of that. With a combination of better prevention and early detection, and also the ability to use genomics, where you can match the treatment to that patient's specific tumor, where you've actually looked at that tumor DNA to know what's driving it, and immunotherapy, which has come along in a way that has saved countless lives, particularly for things like melanoma, which used to be a death sentence, and leukemias and lymphomas after they failed to respond to chemotherapy. Sometimes immunotherapy works like a charm. So we're on a roll, but we've still got a long way to go, particularly with the ones that are still so frustrating, pancreatic cancer, brain tumors, glioblastoma, and childhood cancers that don't respond. We did really well with childhood leukemia, but childhood sarcomas and childhood brain cancers, we still aren't doing well. And that's where we need to make a big push now.
I know from just recent experience of a very dear friend in the Bay Area who had a very unusual cancer. She happened to have a close friend who was a specialist in that very genetic marker and was able to get her the treatment almost immediately that zeroed in on that particular treatment. And it shows great promise. So I certainly have had a personal taste a little bit of what you're talking about and the significance of this kind of targeted genetic treatment. It's really a remarkable breakthrough. When you look back on the Human Genome Project, just moving into that area, and for anyone that was aware of that process and that extraordinary achievement, I just wonder if there were moments along the way that you would share with us about that experience that begin to connect more specifically also with your sense of what you later call, quote, the language of God in that best-selling book that you've written. Give us a little glimmerings into how those two things in that process as it was unfolding began to converge.
Well, I'd become a Christian at age 27 when I was already in medical research and also in medical training. And it was DNA that had caught my imagination from the beginning of medical school. So I knew I wanted to work in genetics in some way. I never dreamed I would be called to lead the Human Genome Project in 1993 and to have the chance to stand at the helm of that particular international ship for the course of the next 10 years. But it did very much feel for me, like a believer, that we were reading this language of our own instruction book, which for one who appreciates that we are here because of God the Creator, it's God's language. And as it emerged bit by bit, with no small amount of up and down and moments where I thought I might have to be the one to admit the whole thing wasn't going to work. Ultimately, in the last few years where everything really came together, all of these 3 billion letters of our own DNA code came spilling out. We made a commitment to put it all up on the internet every 24 hours. This is a gift from God. This is our shared inheritance. Nobody should be claiming this as theirs. It's ours, and it's a gift. And when we got to that point, well, it was a particular day that I think the public began to realize something really happened here, which was June 26th, 2000, where there was a ceremony in the East Room of the White House to announce that we had arrived at a really good draft. It wasn't quite complete, but it was 90%. I got up that morning at 5 a.m. to figure out what I was going to say in that particular event. And it was a poignant day because the night before I had spoken at my sister-in-law's funeral, somebody I was very close to who had died of breast cancer. And the contrast here of cancer having taken somebody much too young, and then here we were going to make this announcement about this new glimpse into the fundamentals of everything living, just seemed very striking and very poignant. And so in my remarks, which oddly enough, the White House didn't ask to review ahead of time. Nowadays, I'm sure they would have. Somebody messed up that day, but that was okay. I talked about this as a gift from God, that we had uncovered something that humans had not seen before, but God knew all along. And that, I guess, among some of my scientific colleagues felt that was a little out of line, but many others really, I think, appreciated it. President Clinton clearly appreciated it.
Well, it was such a memorable moment. I remember watching that and thinking how it was a moment that was changing human history, that we would never any longer have the absence of that information, that we would have it going forward, that it would end up unfolding in ways of extraordinary significance yet to even be imagined. But so much has happened since that time. And the work that has been built on, a lot of which is partly connected to the work that you've been doing in the last several years related to the virus. And I just wonder if you could talk about how one helped the other.
Yes. Well, a direct connection there is just the technology. In order to read out our own 3 billion letter instruction book, we had to really take what was a pretty clunky way of reading the letters of DNA and RNA and scale it up to make it really fast and really accurate and really cheap. So when you now hear about the latest variant in SARS-CoV-2, whether it's alpha or beta or delta or now Omicron, or maybe it's Omicron BA2. How do we know that? Because the genome is sequenced using the same technology that was developed during the course of the Genome Project, although now it's even better. So this ability to be able in very rapid form to acquire vast amounts of information about nucleic acids, DNA and RNA, is one of those spin-offs of the Genome Project that otherwise wouldn't really have happened. And is pretty much taken for granted now by graduate students who can't imagine how you ever could have done anything in biology without having these tools of sequencing and, of course, the internet, where you can pretty much go and pull down all the sequence information from anything anybody else has ever done. It's incredibly empowering. And without that, I think the COVID-19 crisis would have been infinitely worse. So we have built a lot of our accomplishments on previous generations of technology development.
Right, right. It's all about sequencing, isn't it? How these events become their own sequencing. It's such a gift. Francis, you've landed yourself or been landed in the convergence of faith conversations, science conversations, government conversations, and political conversations. And that's just really quite a stew to be living in. So I want to pull them out a little bit from each other and have you talk about them briefly separately, but then also about what happens. Because I think often we're left unaware, really, of how this goes on behind the scenes. We see the evidence of something having gone on, but it's sort of unclear how all these things actually interact with us. So your faith, you've spoken about and written about The Language of God Again, is a magnificent biography in part of your own journey and the significance of how faith emerged for you and how it took claim of your life, how it helped define your understanding of what being human means, and certainly the usefulness of your gifts and your interest in science, a strong commitment to the truth. Let's just start there and let that ground you, because I know that it is the grounding of what you do.
Absolutely. I had not been raised in a home where faith was considered at all relevant. So I was an atheist in graduate school studying quantum mechanics. It was going to medical school and sitting at the bedside of people who were dying that forced me to wake up to the fact that I hadn't really thought about these really profound questions about, is there a God and does God care about me and why am I here anyway? And that led me through a two-year journey with a lot of help from C.S. Lewis and ultimately from the New Testament and the Old Testament to recognize that there was truth there that I was hungry for and ultimately ready to give myself to. I have never in the last, 44 years, encountered a circumstance where my Christ-centered faith has led to a conflict with being a rigorous scientist who really wants to understand how nature works. The BioLogos Foundation that I had the privilege of getting started about 14 years ago continues to be a wonderful meeting place for like-minded people of that sort. And I think they talk about this as God's word and God's world because they're both gods. Or in the words, I guess, of Francis Bacon, God giving us two books, the book of God's words, the Bible, and the book of God's works, which is nature, which science gets to reveal secrets of. And I find that to be enormously satisfying and not at all in conflict. And I'm not a fan of the Stephen Jay Gould version of this, that these have to be non-overlapping magisteria. They overlap in my brain every day and in my prayers. When we're trying to find a vaccine for COVID-19, I'm going to pull every scientific expert together with every kind of creative approach to make it work. But I'm also going to be in prayer for God's help to make the answer come out to save lives. And that feels fine to me. Why would I not want to bring every source of inspiration and power together?
Yes, yes, yes. We'll come in a moment to the crisis that that creates for not just for some scientists who are skeptical of your faith, but for some Christians who are skeptical of your faith because of your science. So I want to come back to that in just a minute. I wonder if you could then take us. You have this faith that deeply grounds your understanding of truth, your pursuit of scientific truth, and of truth of the knowledge and grace and mercy and goodness of God in Jesus Christ. You also then are deeply immersed in, first, of course, academic medicine, now in research science purely in the context of a governmental bureaucracy of an exceptionally large kind that reaches across the United States and beyond. So tell us about taking all of that to a government role, an appointed government role.
Yeah, I was pretty skeptical about how that would work when I got the invitation to come to NIH to lead the Genome Project in 1993. I consulted with my mother because that's what you're supposed to do. And my mother was a very wise advisor. And she said, don't do it. One thing, as she said, I hope none of my four boys would ever become is a federal employee. So just say no. And it was, I think, the only time I basically rejected my mother's advice because I was so excited about being able to have a hand in leading this revolutionary effort about the genome. And yeah, it is complicated working within the government. There is a lot of bureaucracy, to be sure. I think we're fortunate, though, the National Institutes of Health, in some ways, is insulated from a lot of that because it really is a scientific organization. It has amazing people who are there because they're inspired by the possibility. And we pretty much have been able to focus our energies in a way that made the most sense for science progress. And sure, I had to oversee, when I became NIH director, an institution with a budget now of $42 billion a year, and all the need to make sure I was justifying how we were spending it to the Congress, because they want to know that.
Right.
I kind of enjoyed that, actually. It is sort of an opportunity to be part of the system when it's actually working. And fortunately, medical research, for the most part, with some cracks in this in the last couple of years, has been above the fray, has been really something that both parties and both houses and all administrations could say, yeah, this is a good use of government funds. Go to it. Find some cures. Get busy. If you need more resources, come and tell us why. And that was making my life a lot easier, even in the course of 12 years and three presidents, than a lot of other people who live in the government where things were much more likely to get political. It's gotten a bit more political lately.
We'll come to that next. It's my question, really, which is that it's one thing to be in faith in science that has a kind of construct that you've just sketched for us that is comprehensible and, from my point of view, very, very exciting. It's a kind of harmony like that you've discussed so beautifully in your 2020 Templeton Prize speech, which was just such a wonderful capturing of that kind of integration. You move it into government service. You find, it sounds, very practical ways of being able to marshal all of these resources, which is itself, I'm sure, highly demanding, but also very exciting to think that all these things can actually be channeled. And then all that gets also swallowed up, I would venture to say at times, in the last number of years in the field of politics and the intense partisanship. So take us then into that additional layer.
Well, yes, and that's particularly emerged, sadly, at a time where we could least afford it, faced with a global pandemic. I guess I was naive enough to think this would certainly be a moment where all of us faced with a real enemy called the virus would figure out how to work closely together to do everything we could to try to prevent loss of life. And for various reasons, that really is not what happened. And at the moment, now, here we are in the third year of this pandemic, where you stand on whether you accept public health messages or whether you've been vaccinated or how you feel about wearing a mask is predicted much more by your political party than by anything else. There's something wrong there. Medicine and public health should never have become somehow acquired by politicians and political spokespeople as something that they're going to take sides about. And it's a tragic situation because it's not just an awkward moment where we seem to have a culture war going on. It's actually taking lives. It is probably the case that between 100,000 and 150,000 people have died of COVID-19 needlessly. People who, for various reasons, got misinformation and disinformation about the vaccines and therefore chose not to take advantage of them, then became ill and then died. And many of those were people who thought they were much less vulnerable, people in their 30s, 40s, and 50s who are now in graveyards. That is heartbreaking, Mark, and I didn't anticipate that. I thought the big battle was going to be to develop these particular interventions, the vaccines, the therapeutics, the diagnostic tests. It didn't occur to me that there would be such a widespread resistance to taking advantage of them because of suspicion about science. Suspicion, which sadly has had fuel added to that fire from political perspectives that just didn't belong there, but are now pretty deeply entrenched.
And they're deeply entrenched in the church as well. So we've talked before about this epistemic crisis, the sense of what is knowledge, what is truth, what can be believed, by what criteria, how can we understand that crisis? So I think I know that you're perhaps going to be turning to a project, trying to write some about this more extensively than you've had time to do. But give us your lens into what it is that you're seeing at the core of that crisis.
I think my own naivete has become more clear to me that I somehow had the impression that if you had evidence and it was really well based upon facts and truth, and you placed that in front of people, that would just settle it. And everybody would go, oh, okay, I see, I get it. But that's not where we are right now. There is such a tribalism And that tribalism is attached to a certain set of core beliefs, some of which are not factual, that when you try to interfere with that thinking by providing an alternative view, which is much more reliable, it gets rejected. I mean, this is cognitive bias in a very, very strong way. And I didn't realize how difficult it would be to get through that particular set of obstacles. Maybe I was being a little too much of a Cartesian, thinking that rationality was going to win, and I should have read a little bit more of David Hume and recognized that rationality is a slave to the passions. And the passions right now are really intense, and people aren't interested in the scientific rationality that might actually save their lives. That's pretty dramatic, isn't it, that it's come to that point.
I'm Mark Laberton. You're listening to Conversing, a production of Fuller Studio. One would think that Christians would have, in particular, an inherent understanding of the value and justice of public health endeavors. But from what we hear from them, by and large, many, many Christians in America just don't have that confidence. What has eroded that from your perspective?
Yeah, you know, I think this goes back a ways, and this was part of the reason to start the BioLogos Foundation, and the reason I wrote The Language of God was to try to address the issue that many Christians have been suspicious about science long before COVID came along. And that relates to the fact that there has been portrayed as a conflict in terms of what science is teaching us about origins, about the age of the earth, about evolution, versus what some readings of Genesis 1 and 2, may I say readings that St. Augustine would never have agreed with, which insist upon a very literal reading of what was never intended to be a science textbook. So that tension has been there for 150 years, and particularly in, I think, more conservative white evangelical churches. And so you come along with something like COVID, where science is saying, here's what you need to do, and other voices are going, no, it's dangerous, don't trust them, scientists are all atheists anyway, it's really the mark of the beast. Those things have been said. There's a chip in that syringe. If you get the vaccine, Bill Gates is going to be tracking you. These are just wild kinds of assertions, but they fall upon a fertile ground here. A general suspicion about whether science is really in your best interest. If you're a Christian who's grown up in this kind of environment of wondering exactly what is going on here, are they trying to undercut our faith? And there's a lot of fear about that. And what happens then when misinformation and disinformation come along, they tap into that fear, and then people don't know what to do. And I don't for a minute think that's because evangelical Christians aren't really smart. They are, but they're given a lot of mixed messages with a background of unease. And on top of that, it's just really hard to see your path forward to doing what might be the best thing for your family, as well as playing love your neighbor for the people that you might expose if you get sick. It's much harder than I thought it would be, even though I think evangelicals would still stand on those pillars that we all believe in about faith and family and truth and goodness and beauty and love. But translating that now into an action about a scientific development that is being presented in ways that sounds edgy and maybe a little dangerous has been really hard. So I'm deeply empathetic with all the folks who are in that spot or sitting in the pew on Sunday morning going, I don't know what to do. And there's this loud voice over here saying it's all bad and it's all dangerous. I don't think that's right, but how do I know? And how am I empowered to respond? I hold really responsible, though, the people who are spreading information that they actually know to be false. And there are plenty of those on the internet, on social media, and some of them are even doctors. And some of them are politicians, and I think history will judge them quite badly.
Right. One of the things that I think people get confused about is science as a progressive development. So even during the period of the virus, there's been this unfolding, ongoing discovery, which then changes advice given by the CDC, for example, that then feels like it plays into a narrative that says, see, science is all just a bunch of bunk. They don't even know what they're doing. It keeps changing. If they knew what they were doing, they would have come out right from the beginning with the exactly right and perfect and unchanging advice. I just think that adds to the narrative that we're discussing.
It totally does, Mark. And I don't think here I will indict myself as one of the people trying to communicate messages from science about COVID. I don't think we did a good job about explaining that this was an area where we were just learning as we went along. And we were undoubtedly going to have to change recommendations when more information came along. That didn't really get heard. And I'm not sure it got said loudly and longly enough. And so people did wonder, okay, you're flip-flopping. And that's a favorite criticism, of course, which has now become a political one, about anything where there was a public health recommendation that was this way 6 months ago, and now it's a different way, which is ironic because wouldn't you want that if you're trying to defeat a biological foe and you're in the process of learning everything you can about it day by day? If you were saying the same thing 6 months later, you really would be incompetent and you should be criticized. It has to change. I often sort of say, if it was your stockbroker and they were giving you the same recommendation today that they did 6 months ago, you would fire them on the spot. They're not paying attention. The market's changed. Well, the virus knowledge has changed too. In fact, the virus itself has changed with new variants. We have to change accordingly to do the best we can with the information we have in front of us. That's what we've been trying to do in public health, but it hadn't come across that way. Frankly, I got to say, I think we need to have a hard look at how our science communication was done and whether there were ways, maybe it's not too late, but maybe for the next pandemic, where we could be more effective. Scientists have this ability to be really good at throwing statistics at you, but that's not really what people respond to. People respond to stories, real stories about real people. Scientists are like, ooh, that's an anecdote. I don't think we'd better rely on that. But if we had a few more stories and a little bit less statistics, I think people might have actually resonated with the message a lot better.
It also strikes me that it's about proximity, because the further you are leaning toward science, the more you're aware of its unfolding character. The farther you lean away from science, the more you want to see it as a sort of static reality that just declares truth from on high and then never changes it. That's a stereotype that has no reality in science, but it's a stereotype about, quote, believing the scientists, right? That kind of trope, which then suggests stability, when in fact, it's much more dynamic than that. And as you point out, is exactly what we need it to be.
And also scientists need to be able to say, and I don't think we said this either, we are wrong sometimes. The good news is that wrong science will not be sustained for long. Somebody will figure out it was wrong and come up with a correction. But there's going to be a time where somebody says, science says this, and it turns out that they actually did the experiment wrong or did the analysis wrong. And even at that point, without having to wait for new data, there was a better answer that just hadn't emerged. And we have to be honest about that, too. I think scientists have portrayed themselves as much too good at what they do.
Yeah. Well, and I think that is another piece of it. One of the things that many have pointed out and admired about you, as I do, is the humility with which you've gone about what you're doing and your willingness to keep laying out that there are mistakes, there are changes, there are refrains, there are things we get right, things we don't get right. And that creates something that feels to me reassuring as opposed to creating disequilibrium. It feels more trustworthy because you're admitting these things rather than the failure to do so. But I think sometimes there are people who feel like that creates the instability that then causes them to walk away even further. And I'm saying this because I want to see how you respond to this, but it seems to me that on the theological spectrum of people, the more conservative and certain a person is, the less likely they are to live in a kind of tension, I think, that the Apostle Paul uses, for example, in saying that we see, but we see through glass darkly, that there's a confidence in knowing and there's a humility in knowing, and both things are always present. And that creates a kind of humility about what you claim to know, but not a claim to know it in certainty and therefore in unchanging reality. And because I believe in an unchanging God, does not mean that I think my view of God should be unchanging, since my knowledge of God is always partial and not complete. I wonder how you think all that figures into this.
Oh, it absolutely does. And it certainly applies, as we were talking about a minute ago, about science, but it certainly applies to me as far as my understanding of faith. I imagine there must be people whose position on faith issues has been unchanged for a couple of decades. I have a problem figuring out how I could possibly say that I've arrived at a place that is mature enough that it doesn't need constant refreshment. And it's often refreshed by arriving at a place of doubt, which then asks you to dig a little deeper, like, where is that coming from? And how can I learn from this? And how can I, as a result of it, build a stronger faith that is more mature? So yeah, all of those things should be growing and evolving as you go along. That's the natural way that I think you get stronger, not weaker.
Let's imagine that you're talking to someone who is in that position, whose faith they would say has been unchanging for potentially decades. And you're wanting to tell them about your faith, which I would venture to say is as assured as their faith, but your conceptualization of it, your framing of it would be different. Talk to that person now and explain why yours isn't an abandonment of faith or a laying down of real trust in God or the assurance of the revelation that God's given in Christ. What are you not saying when you say that it's still an unfolding thing?
I am ready to say absolutely clearly that I'm a follower of Jesus, that Christ is the center of my life, that the way in which I interpret every decision that comes at me has to be grounded in what I'm called to do as a Christian. I may be a scientist who demands a rigor in every examination of the natural world, but I believe in the literal resurrection of Jesus Christ as the foundation of my faith. And I have no problem with God having intervened with God's own natural laws at a time like that to make something that seems humanly impossible. It just adds to my faith. I am so relieved when I face terrible suffering that I don't have to explain to God what that's about, because I serve a God who knows suffering. And that is a great source of comfort and reassurance. When you feel like you don't know what to say, you realize you don't have to. I do struggle all the time about my tendency to grab onto decisions and issues and say, I got this one, instead of, God, I really need your help on this one. This has been a good week for saying, God, I really need your help, because I'm in a new role in the White House that I had not expected. And there's all kinds of complexities that I wasn't prepared for. But most of the time, I'm a little bit more likely to say, okay, I'm okay here. I can manage this. And that's probably one of my greatest weaknesses. And what is the verse that says, my strength is made perfect in weakness? God speaking to me. Okay, got to work on that a little bit more. But I think I could speak to any person strong in their Christian faith, and we would have no problem identifying these areas of great overlap in what we believe. These pillars that we stand on are the same pillars.
Right, right. The challenge, of course, that many pastors experience, and it's part of why you started BioLogos, is this interpretive challenge of how you invite people into faith science discoveries of their own acquaintance and maturation that comes through reflection and appreciation for what each contributes to our life overall. And I just wonder if we can bring this to a point of talking briefly about local congregations and individual pastors. What do you think can be done in local congregations to help faith and science dialogue and integration actually unfold constructively? What needs to happen in an ordinary congregational setting that might take what you've been talking about and move it into that kind of a format or context?
I think some congregations have been doing that, often built upon some members of the congregation who are comfortable in both of these worldviews, the science and the spiritual, and who see them as complementary and harmonious, and can kind of help others who are maybe a little uneasy about this to enter that space and see how this is not a source of anxiety, but actually of joy. And using materials, and BioLogos has many of them, and I know many have chosen just to read through the language of God, not that I'm trying to promote it, as a means of starting the conversation. I think it's hard for pastors on their own to do this leadership if they don't have some support in the congregation, because pastors have a lot on their shoulders right now. And certainly there are pastors who have tried to get engaged in these conversations and have not been well received, but I think they could be. Again, the goal is to try to bring this forward to help people see that science is not a threat to your faith. Science is an opportunity for worship, isn't it? It's like, okay, God gave us creation and gave us a brain to be curious about creation. And science is the way we take our curiosity and we discover things. And when we discover something, that's a glimpse of God's mind. And we should say, hooray, hallelujah. Okay, I'm going to write a paper about it, but I'm also going to say, thank you, God. This is just such a gift. I'm in a cathedral, not the laboratory. It feels like the same thing, really. And to get that sense of awe conveyed, which I think a lot of people don't know about unless they've had a chance to hear from somebody who does it.
Right, right. It's an expansion of imagination, a theological imagination that allows a person to see this integration in a way that pure rationality, for example, or pure emotional approaches to faith often are not able to somehow integrate. What you're describing to me is a great hope, which is about the deep integration of faith and science, not just getting certain tags right, but actually discovering the depth of the integration. Is that right?
Yes, that is right. And to see the beauty of how it all fits together.
Yes.
Beauty, of course, being another feature that is special for humanity that I see as a signpost to God, that God wants us to be able to have those experiences of beauty. And some people think of those as, you know, a beautiful piece of music or a beautiful sunset. But I also think of it as a scientific discovery where you see the elegance of how the cell works, or in other areas of science, an equation that describes how matter and energy behave. That's beautiful. It's simple, it's elegant, it's beautiful. That's a glimpse of God the Creator's amazing capabilities to have given us this gift. And that's a joy to be part of.
Yes, 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 yes. There was a chemical engineering professor that I knew in Berkeley who used to talk, as I've heard you talk, about the worship that happens in his lab as he was working on DNA, as he was working on the matters of the kinds of projects that we've been discussing, and just this sense of how much it expanded his vision and deepened his understanding of God. It is just an extraordinary thing to hear people that are in that vortex like you are, like he was, express that. So I have two more things I wanted to ask about before we finish our conversation. The first is that one of the big scientific realities on the table, in addition to the virus, of course, is climate change, because climate change is another faith-science tension or collision, and it represents itself in so many different ways. There are people who believe that it's really just propaganda for economic reasons or for social reasons. And there's other people who believe that it's absolutely not. It actually is real science, that it actually is the crisis of the earth, that it actually is the biggest crisis that we've ever faced as citizens of a planet. So in the brief time we have remaining, how would you take some of the lessons that you've learned from working, especially on the coronavirus, into the climate crisis?
Yeah, Mark, I'm glad you're bringing it up, because that is, in the longer term, the greatest threat to our planet and our future on this planet. If nothing happens, the course that we're on would lead by the end of the century to really dramatic changes in human life, with maybe as much as a 7-degree increase in average temperature and flooding of many of the parts of the world where some of the most impoverished and most densely populated groups are currently located. It would be devastating. But yet, 28%, only 28% of evangelicals accept that climate change is real and that humans are the main contributor to the fact that it has escalated so dramatically in the last 100 years, and especially in the last few. There's not really a challenge here if one is willing to look at the data. It is absolutely incontrovertible that we're on a bad pathway. But there are many messages out there. Again, misinformation, people who are genuinely unclear about this, but frankly, disinformation, some of it with economic motivation by people, for instance, who don't want to stop using or selling fossil fuels. And it's confused people. And again, Mark, I think it's tapping into this tradition over the last 150 years of some skepticism about science. And there are theologians who also look at the words of Genesis about having dominion over the earth and would argue, therefore, that God wouldn't give us a planet where our own activities could do harm to it. God would have planned it better than that. I don't see how that can be a defensible argument, but it's out there. Flip it around the other way, and I think what it says is dominion means stewardship. That means taking care of the gift you've been given and not abuse it. And we are on a path towards really terrible abuse of God's creation. And it's up to all of us, and maybe especially Christians, to recognize that and take action. I'm reassured that younger Christians seem to get this. They seem to get it really well. But the older generations, and I think, again, perhaps influenced by messages that are frankly driven by money, have not quite had the ability to see the facts as clearly as they are available to us. So this is another focus now of BioLogos, taking this on as creation care ought to be something, if we're talking about science and faith, a place where we could get together, look at the evidence, and agree with people like Catherine Hayhoe, who's now become part of the advisory group and who's been such, I think, a stirring, thoughtful Christian scientist voice of what we know and what we need to do. So yeah, if we don't figure out how to reach this harmony, we're putting the whole problem of creation care in jeopardy too.
Yes. Catherine Hayhoe's book, Saving Us, has been an example of a book that I've just found extremely helpful and accessible for people who are non-scientists to really understand the scope of some elements of the science, but also the social arguments that are being constructed around how climate change is being handled. And she speaks quite overtly in this book as a Christian, as an evangelical Christian, who wants to take the science and life of faith with equal seriousness and to allow them to speak deeply to one another. So I was delighted when I heard that she'd become part of BioLogos as well. It's really, really great. One final question, and that is this, that you are up to new enterprises as you've taken on what you referred to earlier as this unexpected invitation to become the acting science advisor to the President of the United States. So tell us what that means and what it is that you're going to be busy with over the next interim months while they look for the next long-term appointment.
Well, the person who was carrying this role previously left rather suddenly, and there was an urgent need to keep momentum going. And that's when I got the call. And I do have a public service gene that seems to be pretty active. And once again, it fired. And so I couldn't say no. It was not what I thought I would be doing in 2022, but I'm honored and privileged to be able to help. My tasks are to try to be sure that everything about the administration's agenda that relates to science is on the right track. And that means I'm now co-chair of something called the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, which has a very broad range of topics, everything from pandemic preparedness to wildfires. So all of that has to be thought about. There is a big effort right now, Mark, to start a new agency for biomedical research that would move even more swiftly and boldly than what NIH has been able to do in the past, following the lead of what the Department of Defense has had called DARPA, which is how we got things like GPS and internet. I'm a big fan of that. The president really wants to see that happen. That's what I'm spending most of my time on right now, is to try to get that one over the finish line, because Congress has to agree that this is something worth doing. I'm also involved in searching for my successor, because the National Institutes of Health is currently being led by a very capable acting director who is waiting for a chance to be relieved of those duties so that a new person can come on and take the reins. And that now seems to be my job, to find the right person, which I'm glad to be able to do. So yeah, I got plenty to keep me busy.
Yeah, no doubt about that. Francis, I know that I speak for many, many people all around the world and certainly across the United States in just wanting to say thank you. Thank you, first of all, just for who you are as a person, that you're a man of integrity and truthfulness and humility, candor, and great compassion. Thank you that you are such an extraordinary scientist and done the dogged work of the hard science that has to be done. And I know that you've done it as part of wide teams of people that are doing this as well. But you've also done your own part in all of that. And I'm just extremely grateful that a Christian person like you would be so invested in the work of science as a faithful disciple, seeking to worship God in the Word of Scripture and also through the book of nature. And I also want to just say thank you for being, quite specifically, such a faithful disciple. I can't imagine really the intersections that you live at continuously. But what I celebrate is that you, at the core, have this clarity, this groundedness, this rootedness that really does define how you live and how you work. And it comes out of the love and truth and mercy of Jesus Christ. So I'm just so, so grateful for the concrete work that has changed and is going to change literally millions and millions of lives. So thank you so much. And thank you for your part in this conversation today.
Oh, thank you, Mark. And everything you've just mentioned comes about because of God's grace. And I am a privileged and fortunate person to have had many blessings. So thanks. It's been great talking to you.
You've been listening to a production of Fuller Studio. Fuller Studio provides articles, podcasts, videos, and other resources for a deeply formed spiritual life. Subscribe on your favorite podcast app or visit us at fuller.edu/studio.